Greetings, listeners. Before we get into this episode, a few quick announcements. First, we had originally planned to drop an episode on Jordan Peele's film Nope before this episode, but due to scheduling conflicts, we are postponing the episode until our next season. We do have one more episode to come out as part of this season, though, so stay tuned next week when we drop our Nightmare on Elm Street retrospective episode. That brings me to my next announcement. Our next season will be starting the first week of April, so do not worry, we're only going to be gone for a few weeks. This episode was edited by Matt May, who I am extremely grateful for, as he was able to step in and edit this episode as my computer is in the shop. Long story there, I might talk about it in the retrospective though. Content warnings for this episode include discussions of domestic violence. And finally, this was such a great conversation with the co-hosts of Horror Queers. If you have not already, definitely check out their podcast. So without further ado, here is our episode on Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. Greetings, you're listening to Horror Nerds at Church, a ridiculously queer podcast where we take a deep dive into a horror film and talk about how it connects to queerness, religion, and theology. My name is Pace Warfield May, and I am the made-for-TV adaptation from 1997 that tries so hard to be cool and literary, but fails so spectacularly.
Oh, wait, do we just go?
Yeah, go.
And I'm Trace, and I'm the facial expression that Jack Nicholson wears to anything that Shelley Duvall says and or does in this movie.
100%. Love it.
And I'm Joe, and I'm Danny riding that damn bike all through the Overlook Hotel.
Right? Oh my gosh.
I think the 1997 miniseries is fine.
You're entitled to... wrong opinion.
Oh, here we go. We're starting off.
I applaud that.
I love it. So listeners, we are joined by the amazing co-hosts of Bloody Disgusting's Horror Queers podcast, a show in which they discuss a horror film with LGBTQ plus themes, a high camp quotient, or both. And if it isn't explicitly queer, that's fine. They'll watch the film through a queer lens and apply a queer reading to it anyway, which I love because everything can be queer if you want it to be, folks. Oh my God. It's okay.
Yeah, very much so.
But thank you both for being here. I've long wanted y'all, ever since I started this podcast, I was like, I need to get the Horror Queers on here. They're like the original queer horror podcast. So y'all are the trailblazers.
We should be clear. We're actually not.
I was saying, we're not the first, but
but we like to think we've had skin in the game for a little while, just to steal a line from Kiki Palmer.
There you go.
It's cultural appropriation, Joe.
This is true. Yes, I'm going to be canceled by Jordan Peele. Sorry.
So, for listeners at home, just so you know, Emily is out. There's a family emergency, but they'll be back. And this episode is probably coming out a little bit late, too, on y'all's feed, so because of that. But eventually it'll come out, and we're wishing them all the best. But we asked this question of all of our guests on the podcast. If you have a real-life church horror story, oftentimes it's supernatural with, like, a few people have told us exorcism stories, which is wild.
Oh my God.
But more often than not, though, it's just like church people being shitty, which is such a real thing. So do either or both of you have one you'd like to share with us?
I'll just do a 1-2 punch. It wasn't really in church, although I never really liked church. I grew up Catholic and I didn't particularly enjoy it, but I went through the whole, you know, the sacraments, getting my Eucharist and reconciliation, and I got fucking confirmed when I was a junior in high school. Great. But no, I had to go to those weekly Catholic classes after school. So every Wednesday after school, I would go to my church. And one of those, like, stinky, like, you know, it just smells like an old building type things.
So yeah. Yeah.
My CCE, my Catholic Children's Education. And that was, like, every year from, like, first through eighth grade. And There were two things. One, when I was in sixth grade, and I might have been too old for this anyway, so I'm probably embarrassed, but I found out that Santa Claus was not real when I was in sixth grade in Catholic children's education, and I was really upset. And because I was mad because he wasn't real, but I was also mad because my parents didn't tell me. And when I got in the car, I yelled at my mom, and she just goes, "Trace, did you really think Santa Claus was real?" And I was like, "Great, that really helps my trust." Wow. My trust issues.
Right, right.
The other one, though, so this was actually during confirmation classes. Those were longer. Those were much longer. And so I just remember a friend telling me, like, she's sitting next to me. She was kind of like the rebel girl who, like, didn't want to be there either. And she told me masturbation was a sin. And I was like, that's not true. And she just she just raises her hand and goes, "Excuse me, Trace doesn't think masturbation's a sin," like in front of the entire class of these church kids.
Outed by the bad girl. Come on.
And the guy was like, "No, yeah, it is a sin because, you know, you are," I think his reason was, it was like, you're like the sperm you are ejecting from your body are potential life.
Every sperm is sacred?
Yeah, every sperm is sacred. Every sperm is sacred. It's what is that? The Legally Blonde joke where it's like, every masturbatory emission could be deemed reckless abandonment. But that's what that is, but like the religious side of it.
Yes, yes.
So that's my stories.
Love it.
Oh my God. Well, mine are decidedly less exciting. I probably should have gone first. I was raised agnostic. My parents are not particularly religious, and they didn't really want to force that on my sister or I. So they were like, if you get interested in religion, we'll support you, but we're also not going to make you do anything because as children, that doesn't seem right. But they did acknowledge my request to go to a Christmas Eve mass one year because I was like, well, what's the big deal? We should go and check it out. And lo and behold, we got a full fire and brimstone, and like everybody's going
on
to hell
Christmas
if we don't
Eve
change
even?
Our... Yeah, it was Wait. A very like, y'all wow. need to change your fucking ways as you go into this new year and we're celebrating the birth of Christ.
What
so...
denomination? Was this Catholic? I was going to say, because like, I mean, Catholic Christmas Eve mass is like, okay, but it's not fire and brimstone.
Well, it was shocking. Like, my parents looked very upset afterwards. Wow. Like, oh fuck, we didn't think it was gonna be like this, or else we wouldn't have really agreed to it.
Well, so when you came out, then that should have been your thing where it's like, well, at least I didn't do that.
There you go.
Yeah, but that was enough for me to decide, oh, I don't really think this is my jam, so I'm not probably gonna revisit here pretty often.
Yeah.
Well, listeners, we're going to talk about The Shining by Stanley Kubrick. But before we do that, just wanted to give many of our listeners, I'm sure, probably already know about Horror Queers. But if in case they don't, do you mind saying a little bit more about what y'all do, where y'all got your start, all that fun stuff?
Absolutely. Yeah. So Trace and I are both writers for Bloody Disgusting. And the story goes that I took notice that Trace was one of the only people who ever referenced his sexuality in his reviews. So I reached out, I pitched the fact that we should write an editorial series together focusing on queer horror. We did that for about a year, and then we started a podcast, and we've been doing it for about 4 years now.
Yeah, we are in our fifth year. Wait.
There we go. Yes.
We are in our fifth year, but it's been
wow,
4 years.
Really? Jeez. Mm-hmm. That makes me feel old, because I started listening to y'all like in March of 2019. I think 2019 is the first year y'all started, so I was like...
Pretty
so
early.
Now I feel old. The pandemic just feels like 1 year. Like, I can't believe it's been 3 or 4 years of pandemic.
It really does. Like, whenever we started, I was like, I looked at podcasts. I wasn't like much of a podcast listener. Like, I listened to like We Hate Movies and stuff like that. And so, but I remember being like, oh, they've been on for 11 years. Like, I can't imagine having a podcast for 11 years. Not because I didn't want it,
right.
Because I didn't think it was possible. And we're halfway there almost.
It's wild. That's really cool. Some of our listeners may have also seen, it's a little late for this now, but we have our own Advent movie calendar that we've done for like two or three years now. Oh, and then y'all did one this year too. So I was like, ours isn't that scary. Like, we do real horror, of course, but we also try to mix in a few like more family friendly stuff. I know you all have on your feed like stuff like Scooby-Doo and stuff like that. Awesome stuff. But
I will give credit to Joe for that, because I wake up one day and I just see on our Twitter feed, like, Advent calendar. And I was like, Joe, do you even know what Advent is?
It's the thing you open and get chocolate for 24 days every December.
Yes, perfect. Exactly. So that was really cool. And so I was able to be like, hey, listeners, if you want more, like, for our probably the majority of our listeners who are, like, super into horror, then y'all can check that out. But we have a little bit more watered down one for ourselves. Mm-hmm. Like, last season, we go season format. Yeah. So our first season was Halloween. We basically do a franchise, and then like every other week we do a film that is not part of a franchise. So it's like a one-off film every other week. So first mm-hmm. season was Halloween. Second season was Friday 13th. Third season was Twilight. And then our one-off films were all vampire related. Right. So a lot of fun stuff with that. And so this one we are doing Nightmare on Elm Street. I'm wearing my Nightmare on Elm Street.
It's like a Christmas sweater.
That's so cute. Christmas sweater with Freddy on it.
Is it knit or is it just like a regular like polyester?
It's just printed. It's printed to look like it's knit, but
I mean it doesn't suck. But like it would have been better if it was knitted.
100%. 100%.
Yeah, but it's winter.
It is winter, and I live in Minnesota where it's pretty cold. Ooh, okay. Maybe not as cold as like Canada where you live, Joe, but probably close.
Yeah, I'm the warmest, and I'm in Denver.
So yeah, Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, 1980. I'm so bad at transition, so y'all can make fun of me since I'm sure y'all are much better. But when was
sometimes. Right? Sometimes. Joe is better than I am. I'm very much like, anyway, moving on.
Anyway. But so what was the first time y'all have seen this film? I'm sure y'all have seen it many, many times and many, many years ago for the first time, I'm sure.
You can go first, Joe, if you know.
Gosh, I don't remember the first time I saw it. I think I went through a Stanley Kubrick phase when I was trying to be like an art house fag, and it was very demoralizing because the movies are long and hard. And
yeah,
I mean, title of my sex tape, but not what you're looking for when you're like, I'm getting into horror movies.
Right.
Anyway, I don't feel like I really appreciated it until I went to a double bill screening at the Second Run Revival Theater back in Ottawa, and they did The Exorcist and this. And that was a very long double bill, but it was like kind of perfect. And it really helped to set the tone because The Shining was second. So it was very much a, okay, we're going to do religious dread, and then we're going to do soft religious dread.
I actually first heard about this film and first saw clips from this film when I saw the movie Twister in the 1990s.
What?
Oh,
because
right.
the drive-in scene when the Twister comes, they're watching The Shining.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what it was, but my dad was like, oh my God, Trace, that's... Again, I was 7 when Twister came out, so I probably saw it when mm-hmm. I was 8. But my dad was like, Trace, that's The Shining. And I was like, I don't know what that means. But also, on Cartoon Network growing up, they used to do always these little bumpers like during Halloween, like between commercials. Yeah. And there was one of this cat that was driving on a tricycle, like through the overlook. And he, like, you know, stops. And there's two other, like, mice, I think, that are like, come and play with us. And he covers his eyes and it, you know, ends. But I was like, I don't know what that means. But I finally saw it for the first time when I was visiting my grandparents. And they had HBO, which I did not have when I was growing up. And so I actually didn't get to watch it in full, but I definitely tuned in shortly before the Room 237 scene. And I didn't know I was watching an unedited version until Her Pussy Ooh. Comes out. And Ooh, then I was like, yep. Oh, this is great. So I'm going to keep watching it. I actually probably didn't see it in its entirety, though, until years later. Probably not until I was in high school. I've always like liked it. I will say the first time, like when I was a kid, I did think it was quite boring because it's very much not
it's
an
slow.
Action-heavy movie. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's 2 hours and 25 minutes. Unless you watch that European cut, which is
oh my God.
2 hours? Well, I was going to watch it on Tubi, and I saw it was 2 hours. I was like, that doesn't seem right. I feel like this movie's almost 2.5 hours. It's the European cut on Tubi. Fuck you guys. But yeah, sorry. That was a long-winded way of saying I finally saw it when I was in high school, and I liked it.
Oh, good, good. I've talked on the podcast before about like how my parents introduced me to horror like way, way too young, as probably the case of many of us. But this was one of the ones I saw pretty young age. I was probably like 7 or 8. And we're watching it downstairs, probably close to Halloween, like as a family. My dad gets up to go use the restroom. And then like 10 minutes later, we hear the rev of a chainsaw. He comes in. He's like, here's Johnny with the chainsaw.
Oh my
like,
God, no.
Shit myself.
Wrong movie, like, dad.
Right, right. But
it's a crossover.
Yeah.
It's a crossover, yes.
Wait,
yes.
Did you like it when you were 7 or 8?
I think I identified a lot with Danny at that time. So like I kind of liked it for that reason, but I don't think I understood pretty much anything that was going on. One of the scenes though that really stuck with me from that age though is the maze scene where he covers up his tracks and stuff. So I was like, oh, that's so smart.
He is.
Like,
he's super smart.
Yeah, he's very smart.
So
yeah. I guess I never thought about that though. Like having a kid in a horror movie is a good proxy if you are a kid. It gives you something to like latch on to.
Or be absolutely terrified about, because you're like, oh, that could be me. Oh, look at all this terrible shit that's happening to
especially
this
when my dad runs in with the chainsaw during a horror movie.
I guess I just mean that, like, if you, like, again, like, maybe you would have thought it was boring, like, more boring if there wasn't a kid in it, but because there is a kid, you're kind of like, oh, like, I don't know.
And then I also have to shout out another one of my favorite podcasts, Attitudes Podcast, formerly Throwing Shade. They have this joke in there from, like, way back when, about Shelley Duvall being in this film with Steve Buscemi, and how it's like a horse face-off, and they call it romantic films, and it's so hilarious. So I just, that's all I can think of whenever I see Shelley Duvall now. And also that problematic Dr. Phil interview, but yeah.
I've always described her as a unique-looking woman.
Sure. I mean, here's the thing. We used to have actors who had character in their face, right? Like, it was more about their performances. And unfortunately, I do think we've gotten a lot more kind of commercially crass now, right? Like, everybody needs to look like a model. One of the running gags that we have up here, well, I'm not going to claim all Canadians say it, but one of the things we often say is, like, people who work in, like, news and, like, weather up here could never make it down in the States because none of us are pretty enough. It's like, because we look like regular folks.
I mean, most of us in the States look like regular folks too, but you wouldn't believe that from our media. Jesus Christ.
Social media.
That too, yes. Mm-hmm. Also, because this is based, well, kind of based on the book, and we'll get into that in behind the scenes stuff. Have you read The Shining before? And, like, when was your first experience with that?
I definitely have. I got into Stephen King books when I was in seventh grade. I remember I wasn't allowed to read them beforehand because I remember being in fifth grade and grabbing Carrie for the bookshelves. And my mom was asked my, because I was like, it's not a movie. It's a book. I can read a book. It means I'm smart. But my dad was like, no, there's, like, sex scenes in those books. So I wasn't allowed to read it. But finally in seventh grade, I bought Pet Sematary. And that was my first King.
Oh, that's a better one.
there's definitely some sex and masturbating in that book. I think I went Pet Sematary, Cujo, Carrie, and then I read The Shining. And by this point, I had seen most of the film. I really did not like this book when I first read it because I was expecting the movie. Whenever Dr. Sleep was coming out, Dr. Sleep, the book was coming out in 2013. I decided to reread The Shining before reading Dr. Sleep, and I liked it a lot more on a revisit. It's still not my favorite King book, though.
I've read it, but for some reason, I don't remember it well. So when I think of The Shining, my default is always to the film.
Mm-hmm. Same for me with, like, the default to the film, but I know I read the book probably in high school. I don't remember exactly when, but I read it most recently about 5 years ago when I tried and failed miserably to read through, like, all of Stephen King's works, like, chronologically.
Big task. I mean, The Shining itself, though, I mean, again, like the movie, it's a very slow book. Like, there's not a lot of, like, happenings in the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's meditative, right? Like, it's very psychological.
Well, and that's why I enjoyed it more as a 24-year-old than I did as a 13-year-old.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I just want the spooky shit. Where's the murders?
I mean, I felt the same way about Pet Sematary, where I was like, where the fuck's the evil kid? And he's in the last 20 pages of a 500-page novel.
And I guess that can bring us to a little bit of the behind the scenes. Look at me trying to transition again.
Smooth. But I like that one. That one was okay.
Yeah, that was good.
Yay. So the book came out in 1977. The legend is, and this movie has been dissected so fucking much that I'm not going to go into too much behind the scenes here. I mean, just literally, like, exactly.
Look, we're going to give you the Wikipedia version of this because you already know it.
Which, right? The Wikipedia page, though, for this movie is very long.
We're not going to do
0% surprised. But yeah, so the book was inspired by the real-life Stanley Hotel in Estes Park, which is probably not too far from you, Trace.
No. Have you been there yet? It's less than an hour and a half away, probably about an hour and a half away, but I did stay there last year. But it's funny because people always think, oh, that's the Shining Hotel. But it's like, no, that's where Stephen King stayed and is where they filmed that miniseries. But it's not where this movie was filmed.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. It was filmed in Timberline Lodge in Oregon. And King, of course, notoriously hates the film. I get it.
I maybe we'll get to it. But, like, the thing I will quibble with him, and maybe it's because of, like, the passage of time and how we discuss Wendy as a character and Shelley Duvall. But it's like, I get, like... I don't like his critique of Duvall's performance. I don't like his critique of the character of Wendy, because honestly, I think that not just Duvall's performance, but just the way that she is written, like, this role exudes terror.
Exactly.
And it's a very realistic portrayal of how someone would react in this situation, I feel like.
100%. Definitely, like, it's like I used to work in domestic, I've worked in like every sort of job imaginable in my life, but I used to work in a domestic violence shelter. I was their house manager for a while. And wow. Like, this is like legit battered woman syndrome.
Yeah.
On screen.
Oh God. Yeah.
I mean, and look, the way that King wrote Wendy, I get it. Like, she's a badass. And Rebecca De Mornay, I think, does that role pretty well in that 1997 miniseries. But it's just, it's not the same character. So I get his frustration with it not being the same character, but I feel like it's unfair to Duvall to be like
100%.
Yeah.
The one thing that I agree with is like King's critique is the character Jack, like very different. And I get why he wants that kind of redemption arc for Jack and stuff from his own personal life and all that. And I like that in the book, but I nevertheless really like Jack Torrance in this film too.
But I think that's also part in like, it's on this rewatch. That's something I will say is like, there's not really a smooth transition between him, like being normal, quote unquote, to turning insane. Like he constantly looks and acts insane for most of this movie. And so I get that. And so there's not really a lot of tragedy in this film as there is tragedy in the book.
For real, for real. But also, I feel like it fits better with this notion of him already being an abusive asshole before getting to Overlook, and then that just accentuating it. Whereas,
if I recall, I mean, in the book, he still has the thing where he, like, hurts Danny's arm. He's still an alcoholic, but he's not, like, he's not this bad in
true,
the book.
True, true. 100%. Fun transition. Speaking of interpretations of the book and film, there's that Room 237 documentary, which, yikes, I just watched that before this.
Good? It's really good. Yeah.
Pace
is like
I'm all about interpretation stuff. I just there's this level of like sincerity and this trust in Kubrick being like some omniscient godlike director that a lot of the interpretations in that film have that just really make my skin crawl. I'm like, he is not fucking God. He did not literally pay attention to every single detail in every single frame of this film. There are some things that might literally be a mistake, and that's okay. So that's my frustration with some of the interpretation. Like, I like the content of the interpretations. This is just like the level of sincerity and like, this is exactly what it means. It's like, I don't think it really, you're like uncovering this mystical interpretation of what actually is happening here, kind of.
Yeah, because it is a little bit like a conspiracy theory film. Like, ooh, it could mean so many different things. Like, I think that's one of the reasons why people like it is because they do really dig into that. But at the same time, it's acknowledging that the film is a masterpiece, but then it also bequeaths Kubrick as, like, this all-knowing master, which... You know, film is a collaborative medium. And as you said, Pace, like, not everything is intended. Some things are obviously very deliberate, but they really seem to want to take it to the nth degree.
But I think that's how people talk about Kubrick in general, though, right? I mean, without having seen this documentary, like, if you besmirch the name of Kubrick, like, people will come after you.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, he was a fucking fanatic. Like, he was abusive, he was manic, he was kind of out of control. Like, that's what you had to know you were signing up for. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of people who were making the films that he's considered a master for didn't know that that's what they were getting into.
Yeah, right? They're like, oh, it's Kubrick, sure, that's a great career opportunity.
Oh my God, this just ate up 2 years of my life and now I'm on therapy and drugs.
Yeah.
Like I have in the outline here, like, you do not need to traumatize your actors into performances, dude. Like, you really don't need to do that.
I'm glad that all those stories came out. I've seen the footage like once before, and it's definitely one of those things where I'm like, ooh, this
is upsetting.
Too, like, yeah, I like, it's like the who's the guy that bitched out Lily Tomlin on I Heart Huckabees? David O. Russell. I've seen that once and I never need to see that again. Like, it's just, it's real abuse, and it feels like I'm watching a snuff film, even if there's not any actual violence like on display.
Then we get also the made for TV remake, which Trace likes, from 1997.
I mean, it's like a three, maybe it's a three fine. And a half if I'm in a good mood, but like, it's an ABC miniseries. Like, for what it is, I think it's totally fine.
It's better than several other Stephen King miniseries that were made for TV.
Very good point.
Fair. Like, Langoliers? Fucking trash.
Oh, I mean, but, like, oh my God, that's so like bad, bottom of the barrel Stephen King miniseries.
But also so fun.
Kind of. Even as a kid, I found that one kind of boring.
Same. Oh, but Rose really? Red, for instance.
I love though, Balky in it. That's all.
Oh, yeah. That makes sense.
Rose Red's good. Rose Red actually genuinely scared me as a kid.
Yeah, that's my also, like, that's favorite
original,
of his.
That's an original screenplay. And that's... I will go to bat for that 2002 NBC Carrie miniseries with Angela Bettis. I think that one is actually pretty good.
I like that one too.
Yeah. And Emily DeRavin as Chris Hargison. Oh, she's such a good bitch. I love it.
It's good. It's good. And then you already mentioned the sequel to the book, Dr. Sleep, that King wrote in the early 2010s. 2013, I think you said.
Yeah.
And then, of course, made into a film in 2019 with Ewan McGregor. And I love Dr. Sleep, and I feel like it makes the first, it makes The Shining, this film, better from a book standpoint, like retrospectively. Oh. But still, it is, you know, it's not, it's Mike Flanagan. It's not going to be a masterpiece that this film is, essentially. But
well, they're, yeah, they're very different films. And I will cop to it that Mike Flanagan is not going, as much as I love Mike Flanagan, he is not the craftsman that Kubrick is. That's not to say he's not a good director. He is a good director. But it's also like this movie, they're such, both the books and the movies are such different beasts because, well, actually, I'm sorry. The books are actually very similar. But this film of The Shining is like a cold, distant, like hollow film, intentionally so. And Dr. Sleep is very much not that. It's very much all about the feely-feelies. And so it's definitely jarring, but it suits both directors, I think. But Mike Flanagan did not have an easy task making a sequel to the film and the book that somehow worked for some, did not work for others.
Yeah. And I'll be one of those who admit, like, it worked for me, especially, like, the director's cut. The first time when I watched the theatrical cut, I was like,
I mean,
okay.
The book isn't very well written. I think even the book came out, like, it got bad reviews. So again, Flanagan's already working on an uphill battle from there. I do love Dr. Sleep. And I do think it's actually an improvement on that book, because again, the book is fine.
Agreed. And that's all the behind the scenes stuff I have, really. I mean, there's so much here that, like, I could do an entire mini series just about the behind the scenes making this movie, but, that's kind of like broad brushstrokes. Anything that y'all feel like I'm missing or?
No, it's one of those things, like you said, where it's like so much of this stuff is so well known that I don't like feel like it's super necessary to retread that ground. Retread?
Sure.
Revisit.
There we go. But by all means.
Perfect. Well, the next part, we just kind of like walk through some of our favorite scenes and moments before we do like our deep dive. And so, I'm definitely interested in what all y'all have. And I can just start off, though, like, the opening still gets me. Just when I put this on yesterday, I want to say, to watch it, or one sometime in the past 48 hours, like, just as soon as the opening starts and you hear that, like, low bass as a picture appears, just so gorgeous. And yet that...
That's exactly. Gore, man. So good.
And then that dread, that instant feeling of dread that just continues throughout, like, and increases throughout the movie.
So. Yeah. No, honestly, it's not even like particular scenes, although yes, I am a sucker for the baseball bat on the staircase scene. I think that is like the whole typewriter, like, that's fantastic. But it's honestly like I really paid attention to the cinematography more this time. I think this film is gorgeously shot. There are some shots in this movie where I'm like, I would love just a frame of that. Like, be it the overhead shot of the model of the maze that becomes the actual maze, whenever Danny and Wendy are crawling out the bathroom window and you have that great long shot of him down the hill and she's like,
just gonna say that one. Yeah.
So that needs to be on a poster. Like, that is gorgeous. And so again, what we're talking about Kubrick, like, and I know he had help with his cinematographer, John Alcott, but it's God, this movie's so beautiful. I pay attention. That's what I like more about like doing a podcast longer and longer. Like you do start to pay attention to the technical aspects of the film more than you would as a quote unquote normal viewer. And man, this film is just gorgeous to look at.
Yeah. I really appreciated all of the early quiet sequences where they're just showing Jack around and like, you know, okay, let's go into the kitchen, Wendy. And it's a lot of like long kind of walk and talk sequences. And I just think, there's like Trace and I have really come to appreciate also the way that directors negotiate space to introduce viewers, like, here's how you get comfortable to where the film is going to be set so that when the action kicks in, you know where people are at, so we don't have to be like, let's go to the kitchen. Like, we just know, oh, if you go down that stairwell, it's going to be to the kitchen or something like that.
Well, and this was one of the first films to use, like, the Steadicam, and so Kubrick makes the most of that.
Oh my god. Like, I paid so much for this, I'm gonna use it in every shot.
But I like, again, there's something about like having a camera just follow a character, and it's kind of hypnotic almost, like the way the camera moves in this movie, to where you get lulled into this false sense of security, and then to have it switch on you at the end once we get into the more like traditional horror aspect. Horror. And it's like, oh, we're not just like with them, we are with them during all this shit.
It feels so immersive. Like, I think that's one of the reasons why people consider the space an important figure in this film. Like, hypothetically, wherever a film is set should be evocative. You should feel like you know it. And yet, the Overlook Hotel has become iconic because of the way it's shot and the way the characters move within these spaces.
And also the way that that adds to the, like, there's a way of, you said, Joe, about like making the setting comfortable, but also using that to make you uncomfortable at the same time. Like, it's just these long, empty hallways and these meandering labyrinth, like switching from the outdoor maze to the literal indoor maze of the...
Even the carpet looks like a maze. Like, it's all very, very, very intentional. I also thought that we basically, because one thing that I love is like, let's do a typical like genre setup, but in a new location. And so what The Shining does is it takes the haunted house movie and puts it in a hotel instead. And I think that's fantastic. I mean, again, like we get so used to the usual tropes and shit that sometimes a location change is all you need to like freshen up the whole genre or the subgenre. I'm sorry. And I love this. I actually wish we had more time exploring this hotel. I mean, even though, as Joe said, we spend like the first 30 minutes of this movie going through the hotel.
But certain spaces of it still feel like we never really get to it. Like, I remember, not on this watch, but one of the last couple of times I watched it, when Wendy says, yeah, he went into room 237. Did you go into that room? Was that the right room? And you're just like, that means that there's probably more than 237 rooms, and also that there's 236 at minimum that we never get to see. Like, we can presume that they all look the same because so much of this film is about like repetitious visual motifs. And yet at the same time, I'm like, I kind of want to just explore all these different rooms.
I will say, I don't know about the room count, because to me, 237 means on the second floor, and it's second room 37.
Floor. The 37th room. Second
floor. There's 37 other rooms, and I want to explore 36 of them.
But genuine question, actually, though. So do you still find it, or have you ever found this movie to be scary, or have you ever been scared by this movie? Because I know a lot of people really are.
That's a good question. I feel like, well, definitely as a kid, I don't even think I was scared watching it, to be honest. Like, watching it as like 7 or 8 years old, I think I was more traumatized by my dad. But there is unsettling, I will say that. But actually, like, scary, I don't think.
And this isn't meant to be a knock. I'm not trying to be like, y'all, The Shining's not scary. But sorry, Joe, go. You can answer too.
I mean, I think I feel the same way I feel about The Exorcist, where I can understand that other people feel really overwhelmed by it. And I think that there's a really pervasive sense of dread. Like, this movie feels anxious. You know, we're waiting for the pin to drop. When someone finally gets murdered, it's almost a relief because we've been waiting for it for so long. I personally don't find it scary, but I do find it hypnotic and enthralling.
I'm actually glad you brought up The Exorcist, because I rewatched that last year as well. And yeah, I've never really found this movie very scary. It's very atmospheric. It's very moody. And yes, the dread is absolutely there. But I've never, and I think because, I mean, Joe, you've heard me talk about this, where I'm like, when the film is distant and cold, like this film is,
it's hard for me to feel that way about it.
Well, yeah, it's hard for me to feel scared because I don't really have an emotional attachment to these characters. Like, even Wendy and Danny, who are like, you know, the good ones in this movie, I still feel like I don't really get to know them very well. Whereas in The Exorcist, I actually feel very differently. Like, I do find The Exorcist scary, if only though because the connection between Ellen Burstyn and Laura, between Chris and Reagan in that movie, I think is very palpable. And even though I don't want kids, never want kids, will never have kids. I really, really feel for them in that movie. Mm-hmm. And honestly, a lot of the horror in The Exorcist is from the early scenes, not from the exorcism itself.
Oh, yeah. Because all of a sudden, Father Karras becomes the main character, and you're like, oh, I don't care.
Oh, yeah. As soon as Ellen Burstyn's out of that movie, I'm like, okay, like...
Yeah.
Here we go.
But I mean, I find that as I get older, shockingly enough, I start to relate more to older characters in films. So like, I found Duvall's performance utterly enrapturing in this. Like, I think she's always been great. I don't understand why people think she's bad in this movie. I think those people honestly are fucked. Like, her performance is top tier. It's one of the best horror performances ever.
I think it's because people... Again, they view her as a quote-unquote weak woman.
She's weak.
It's like whenever assholes refer to women who suffer domestic abuse, and like, well, why do they stay there? It's like, that's not the right response.
No.
Yeah.
You're doing it wrong. Go retreat. Reflect on what you're talking about.
I do wonder how many people, that they're like, well, it's her fault she's in this situation. Like, I wonder how many people actually think bad about this character. And therefore don't have empathy for her because they blame her for putting herself in this situation.
She's clearly a strong woman just by, like, how much ash she is willing to let grow on her cigarette before she puts into the ashtray. Like, that's a level of trust and strength that I don't think most of us would have who have smoked.
She's willing to risk a fire for that.
Yes.
And then there's always the elevator scene, which is so visually stunning. Oh, right. I think it's such like part of pop culture now, like in the cultural imagination. And yet, like, it always catches me off guard how early it first appears, even before Wendy and Danny are at the hotel when he's having that vision, like really early in the film. And so just the fact that, like, even though I know it's coming, I never expected to come that early.
It's always a thing. There's a lot of very memorable imagery in this film. And, you know, I don't even necessarily know if I follow the rules of the Overlook Hotel. I don't really know, except that it's like the hotel itself. I'm like, what is the hotel? Like, it's just this entity that sucks. And of course, Dr. Sleep will expand on that more. But it's always a thing where, like, at least in the book, I'm kind of like, yeah, but like, did King think this up? Did he know this when he was writing The Shining, or was he retconning this in his brain when he was writing Dr. Sleep? So I'm looking at this as just The Shining, but I love, like, why do we have an elevator full of blood in this movie? Why do we have it? It looks cool, but it's also just symbolic, right? Of like, this hotel eats people and then just vomits them out.
There's always that. It's always mentioned, well, not always, but frequently mentioned, of Jack Torrance reading a Playboy magazine during his interview. It says, like my dude, that's... But at the same time, I am not... I'm not cis. Anytime I'm in a cis male space, like, I feel very on edge. So I'm wondering, like, there's the summertime caretaker, the owner of the hotel or whatever, and we have Jack Torrance for this interview set up. They're all cis men. Like, is this what cis people do? Do they just like read Playboy magazines in front of each other? Is that like part of the male, or at least this cis straight male like pact? I don't know. I don't know what masculinities are like and how that plays out, but
I mean, I feel like it's important to acknowledge that Playboy has a weird reputation where we always think of it as like a nudie magazine, but back in like the mid to late 70s, it would have also been renowned for having very prominent and prolific writers contributing essays. So, you know, the joke, oh, I read Playboy for the articles. Yeah. It's like, no, but that was literally a thing. It's just that we conflate it now with like Hustler and Penthouse, and we think it's all just beeve shots. And it's like, no, there were legitimate like written pieces in there.
But like in the lobby of a hotel with like kids walking around.
You should not be doing that.
It's maybe it was more common in the 80s. I guess, was this filmed in 79, I guess. Mm-hmm. But
well, it's Kubrick, so it was probably filmed in 77.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes. Maybe it was more common back then. I don't know. The times, they are changing.
And of course, we have Dick Halloran in the magical Negro trope, which is from the book, too. Like, in the book, of course, spoilers, he doesn't die.
We dropped the N-word in this movie. I totally forgot about that.
It took me so immediately out of it. And I was just like, oh, right. This is why people of color get so fucking mad at Stephen King. Because he just, A, is always doing the magical Negro trope. But then also is like, and here, have a liberal sprinkling of the N-word. And you're just like, or we could not,
I will say, though, it was... I don't want to say socially acceptable because that sounds like
it was
like
a different time. Yep.
But yeah, but like it was definitely not as taboo back then as it is today. I mean, even as it would have been in the 1990s.
And like, and also in the setting, like two white men in like literally a bathroom, almost like locker room talk. Well, like it's really.
And the ghost is from the, he died in the 70s. So he would have grown up in the time period where it was very common to use that word. So it's a thing where,
look
like,
at us just justifying this.
No, but, right? I'm not justifying it, but I'm definitely saying like this, it didn't take me
out. It was
out
a thing.
Because I'm like, this obviously makes sense. This fucking old timey man ghost who killed his entire family and grew up in that time period would absolutely use that word. But I, because one of the big changes from the novel is that, yeah, like Dick Halloran shows up and immediately gets killed in this movie.
Right.
Something that does not happen in the books, which is why, of course, why of course Mike Flanagan had to do some like magic tricks to have Dick Halloran appear in the Doctor Sleep. Mm-hmm. But I don't know how I feel about Halloran dying. So it plot wise, it only exists so he can bring that snow cat there so Wendy and Danny can escape. That is the only reason, because of his death, that he exists in this film. And so I feel like his death cheapens it. And it, I don't know. It's like, do you think Kubrick was like, I guess we need to kill someone in this movie?
That's what I think. Like, this movie, I mean, Pace, you sent us the cheat sheet and it was like, what's your favorite character death? And Trace and I were like, one. But the reality is, it's like, yeah, I think it's a horror film. We need to kill somebody. And I think in a way it's meant to be a bit emotionally manipulative because you're following him. You think he's going to come in and save Wendy because she is weaker. She is passive. And here's this guy who is literally, well, he's willing to get on a plane from Florida and then drive through this winter snowstorm to get to this hotel. And so I think it's meant to be a, oh, you thought this man was going to come and save her. No, he's not. But it's also like we look at it now in contemporary lenses and it's like, you've got this one person of color and he doesn't get to do much. And then he shows up and just immediately gets killed. And he's like the only death in this movie.
Yeah. I mean, well, but it's also like, sort of. I hate that he didn't get to like meet Wendy or, and not me, but like see her when he gets her, see Danny, like give us something before he dies. But again, maybe that's the point. Maybe it's like this hopeless, like dread induced
thing. It's
so
futile.
Yeah. It's on a level. I do understand why it's here, but on another level, I'm kind of like, But why?
Yeah.
Why you gotta be like this?
Yeah, 100%. And like, and this is another place where Dr. Sleep, like you mentioned, like the magical stuff that had to happen to bring him back, since in the novel, of course, he was still alive. But like, I almost like how Dr. Sleep gives Dick Halloran that a little bit of closure to this movie, and also gives him a little bit of like pushback to like, you just dropped into my kitchen and now you're my problem and now you have to do this kind of thing too. Whereas otherwise this film on its own is like, why is this dude like risking his life for some white kid he doesn't even know, flying all the way across country and then just like dies before he can even do anything. So it just,
unfortunately, in both this and Dr. Sleep, he is very much the exposition machine. And Joe, I will give you this, because I, after finishing this last night, I 100% was like, yeah, sure, I want to watch a 3-hour version of Dr. Sleep. So I did.
Sure.
But I do think, while I appreciate Halloran's ghost in that movie, his dialogue is a bit clunky in how expository it is, and it's kind of like, oh, I felt it more in this rewatch. It doesn't bother me that much, but I definitely can see those complaints more about that specific character in the film.
Sure.
Well, I think that's Flanagan feeling responsible in the day and age that he's making the movie, and also saying, okay, how do I merge the book as well as the previous film, The Shining. It's like, okay, well, let's do some creative sewing and try to really like make this work. It's going to be great. And I think he does probably the best he can.
Yeah,
and like you said, Pace, I think people are actually really happy that we got to see this character come back and get a bit of a redemption arc.
Yeah.
Mini arc.
Yeah.
Mini arc. The last thing I have from this is, it's just Wendy adding to her adding to Shelley Duvall's performance and just like how much I really resonate with this character. She's literally doing all the work and maintenance for Jack as he just sits in the damn grand room and does nothing.
I'm not justifying Kubrick's behavior at all, but he did get a hell of a performance out of Shelley Duvall. I mean, most of the last 30 minutes of this movie, this 2-hour and 25-minute movie, are just her looking at the camera terrified. I think it's a really hokey shot, like whenever like she looks in the lobby and just a bunch of skeletons there and it's like, well, this looks like a Spirit Halloween store, but her terror sells it this scene completely. So whereas I'm like, well, I'm looking at a bunch of plastic skeletons covered in fake cobwebs, she makes me buy into this. And of course this is intercut with like Jack doing whatever the fuck he's doing. But I find her such a fascinating person to watch in this film.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Like, I don't want to shit on a child actor, but the reality is like every time we have to see Danny do the like Home Alone, I'm so scared, hands over his cheeks kind of look, I'm like, thank God for Shelley Duvall, because she's bringing like some adult horror to this.
I'm not going to lie, I hate the Tony voice.
Oh my God.
I hate it so much. It's fine
until he starts to do it all the time.
Red Rob!
I was like, Red Rob! Also, Kubrick, I appreciate that every scene does not need to be 5 minutes long. Like, we don't need him just saying Red Rum for 5 minutes while he writes it on the door.
I get it supposed to be
the pacing is very 80s for me.
I get it supposed to be like a result of his abuse. Like, you know, it's oh, like he had a really bad experience where his father broke his arm and he therefore developed this imaginary friend that lives in his mouth. Even though it's not really his imaginary friend, it is
it's the Shining.
Whatever.
But yeah, it's the Shining via dissociative disorder.
Yeah, but this I can tell him not a parent, because literally in that first scene where like his mom is talking to him is like, well, Tony, I'm like, no, you don't. He's not Tony. Slap that shit out of him.
Right.
Or take him to therapy, not just a conventional doctor when he has a fainting spell.
That doctor, whenever she's doing her like cigarette ash thing and like the doctor's like, what?
Ma'am, I'm going to slide a pamphlet that reads trauma over to you, and we're going to encourage you to book your child into a therapy session.
Also, like, here's some stuff on domestic abuse that you might want to take a look at as well for your benefit.
Like I said, this is our Nightmare on Elm Street season, so like I just watched a few weeks ago Wes Craven's New Nightmare, and I want the doctor from that movie to have that concern in this movie and be like... Please, like, get this kid in Child Protective Services or something.
That's actually, because even in Megan, the psychiatrist in that movie is, like, pretty, like, you're like, oh my God, die. But my husband, who is about to get his PhD in counseling psychology, every time he sees therapists in movies now, he's like, that is not how that would actually happen. It's not how you do it. Like, that is not real. And so horror movies are actually the worst at portraying therapists. And it's almost always in a negative light.
Yeah. For sure. I mean, I'm thinking of people's reaction to Scream. Or sorry, not Scream, Smile, last summer.
Oh, yeah.
And just how they were just like, she's supposed to be a doctor, and why are they all treating her this way?
Yeah. It's like, y'all go, like, shadow doctors and nurses when you're writing these kind of scenes. Why don't you do the same thing? I guess they probably can't, because they can't sit in on sessions with therapists.
I think also just like we have to remember this is always meant to be a creative enterprise, right? Like we don't want to see what real therapy looks like. We don't want to see what a real counseling session would look like, because it's meant to be more expedient. It's meant to move the plot along. Or sometimes we need villains. Well, and often, yes, it is these doctors. It is these social workers, unfortunately.
And the fact is that unfortunately, not all therapists are good at their jobs.
I mean, like every profession.
Yeah, no. I didn't mean like most of them are good at their jobs. I mean, like there are bad therapists out there.
If you're a bad therapist, you might be an antagonist in a horror movie.
There we go. Do you know if you're an antagonist in a horror film?
That's funny. I need that movie. Bad therapist, bad Santa, bad teacher, bad therapist.
Ooh, does it star Cameron Diaz?
In my dreams, yes, absolutely.
Anything else that you want to... Either of you want to touch on before we get into like our deep theological discussion of the day?
I don't have anything else to say, actually. I feel bad about it, but I don't.
Well, it's all good, because like we've been saying all along, this film has been dissected so fucking much that like it almost feels like a futile enterprise to even like record an episode on it. But at the same time,
yeah, it's fine.
We're doing it anyway.
We have those. We have lots of those. We avoided doing Nightmare on Elm Street 2 because we were like, what else can we possibly say about how gay this movie is? Nothing. But we found it.
Yep. Oh, speaking though, Patton in the hospital. Did you see that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw that. That's a real bummer.
Well, I guess we'll get into our deep theological discussion of the day then, which is basically horror is one of those genres that uses religion so much more so than probably any other genre, I think. And this one, from both the book and the film, there's this kind of arc of Jacob and Isaac, the sacrifice of Isaac from the Bible, kind of happening there. And I feel like there's this flipping of Soren Kierkegaard there. I don't want to get too much into like that shit, but like basically,
is Jacob and I, is that the one where like he's a father that God is telling him to kill his son?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Mm. So, and then Kierkegaard goes into this, like, how the sacrifice of Isaac is this kind of proof of existential faith crises and that kind of thing. But I feel like this is almost the opposite of that. Jack has this dream, like, early on of sacrificing his kids and then of his kid and his wife. And then, like, later on, like, it becomes the main driving force of his whatever's going on with him. And yeah. It just really seems like it's not the opposite of this is not God telling you to do this, but this evil entity, whether it's the hotel or Jack's insanity, alcoholism, however you want to interpret whatever's going on with him.
It actually reminds me a little bit of Frailty, the Bill Paxton movie.
Yeah, that's a good one. That movie's like heavily explicitly religious, though, too.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I think what's interesting about The Shining is that like, we get a personification of the hotel in the bartender and then later in the former caretaker. I think it's really interesting that they're both white men around the same age and visual aesthetic as Jack Nicholson. Like, I think that's obviously very deliberate. Like, it's a certain kind of person who falls prey to this trope and maybe also like an undiagnosed mental illness, but also, yeah, like that connection to religiosity, right? You know, I think of people who were deemed clairvoyant, but maybe also hysterical because they were talking about getting visions from God. And it's like, okay, well, that's probably your real life mental illness. But in film, we often conflate that with things like religiosity or evil spirits. And I think it's interesting how you can kind of, do you want to go the religious way or do you want to go like the demonic possessed hotel way?
And interesting what you said about like Lloyd and Jack and all being like white men of a certain age, and then Jack even said, quotes Rudyard Kipling saying white man's burden as he's drinking.
Oh my god. I did make note of that, white man's burden. I was like, bah.
That is like super fucking prescient for 1980 though. We were just like, whoa, we've been saying this shit for this long. That is impressive.
Except I feel like Jack was being very genuine when he said white man's burden.
For sure.
Yeah. And then there's also connection to the Maze and Labyrinth of mythology, just beyond just like the visualness of it, basically is being set in some sort of maze, both indoor and outdoor, but also just the ways it calls upon the Minotaur. There's even like, this has been one of those things that's been like talked about, how Kubrick has the bull like picture in the background and stuff like that. But
I was gonna say though, because that's also a big change to the book, because in the book they're hedge like animals, like the hedge, yeah. Like they're carved like hedge animals,
right?
And they come alive and start attacking them. It's not a maze. Oh yeah, and that's in the miniseries. There's a
I was
fucking
gonna
hedge,
say, I feel like I remember that from alive. The miniseries, and it doesn't play well.
It does not play well.
But yeah, so they changed it for a maze in this, and I do think the maze is actually better. It's definitely less hokey. And I'm sure fits into the themes more so than hedge animals would.
it's just so much more mental, right? Because I love that our introduction to it is, oh, I wouldn't want to be out there unless you got about an hour to kill to negotiate it. But then also we get this overhead shot of how fucking big this thing is, and you're like, are we sure 1 hour is gonna cut it?
Well, I think too, I mean, look, obviously we see ghosts in this movie and we know that the ghosts can cause physical harm based on that woman in 237, but there's something that is immediately like, I'm saying hokey, but I even hate that because I mean, I think you can make anything scary. I just don't think that the hedge animals would have fit in with this movie, because it's almost like The Haunting, 1960s The Haunting, 63, Robert Wise's The Haunting, where it's like, you don't really see anything in that movie, and you don't really know, but like there is something going on there. So The Shining is more explicit about it, but I think adding that element of that would just be a bit too over the edge.
Well, I like the idea of the mythology connection there, Pace, because it does remind me of the Minotaur, but also the idea that you would lead something into like this off-limit space, right? It's a bit liminal in its way, but you go out there to make your sacrificial offering. And, you know, in the movie, you initially think, oh, shit, that's going to be Danny. Like, Jack is going to kill his son to appease this and achieve that level of, I don't know, worship to the Overlook where he will be accepted. And instead, in a way, it's actually Danny leading his father as a sacrifice. And that's why we get that final frame of Jack Nicholson, which is now like hilarious and kind of silly looking, where he's just like a frozen human icicle.
Yeah, yeah.
I will say the end of this movie still leaves me wanting. I'm kind of like, oh, they escape. He's frozen. Boom. Movie's over. I mean, I'm sorry. Picture. Movie's over. I'm always left wanting by the end of this movie.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's just because the film denies any kind of climactic confrontation, right? Like, you probably want to see Wendy get her comeuppance over Jack, or be able to say, like, no, I'm protecting my son, or...
I guess even like an epilogue, which maybe might be too much for this movie, but just something, which Dr. Sleep gives us, and I'm fine with that.
There you go. Maybe that's why you like it.
But with this movie, I'm always like, oh, that's it. After 2 hours and 25 minutes, that's it. That's the only movie this long that I've ended saying that.
Also, like, we also watched Terror Train for the season. That was our New Year's episode. And that film, like, as soon as the dude falls off the back of the train, the movie's over. It's like, done. Nothing needs to be
You got what
up.
You wanted. Credits.
Yeah, yeah. But that's a slasher movie. I hate even saying that, because it feels like I'm like,
but we see it more often in slashers and those kinds of films, right?
Well, and it would be like Terror Train is not an emotionally complex or dense movie, so I don't need that. I would need that for something like this. If it was Scream, I would want something like that, because Scream has character work and character development. Terror Train does not have that for its characters.
Okay, but what about The Exorcist? Because The Exorcist is basically like Father Karras throws himself down the stairs. Get an epilogue?
We get an epilogue.
We get a little hug with her.
We see the next day, Chris and Reagan are in their car. Now, granted, we don't get like a, hey, Reagan, how do you feel about the exorcism you just went through? but they do say, like, she doesn't remember any of it. And we get to see them moving out of the house. So we at least get that. That's something where it's like, okay, well, that's where they're going. Of course, we're going to get more of that in those David Gordon Green exorcist movies that we're about to
get. Oh, my God, stop.
But you know what? We also got more of it in the TV show, which did a really good like continuation of that story. So
what you're saying is you want to see a TV show of The Shining that bridges the gap between childhood Danny and adult Danny.
No, I have Dr. Sleep. I'm fine.
It's just funny, right? Like, I wonder if people had these conversations in the years following the release of The Shining, or if it was kind of like, no, we're actually fine. And then when Stephen King publishes the sequel book, people are like, oh, how is this going to work?
But I mean, like, we all know, I mean, like, The Shining was, the movie was not, like, incredibly well received when it came out. It got mixed reviews. It did make its money back. I mean, I think it earned double its production budget, which is great. But, like, because I wasn't alive then, I don't know when it became part of like the cultural zeitgeist of like, this is one of the best movies and one of the scariest movies ever made. Surely by 1996, because Twister was putting it in the movie. But like, when did that switch happen? I have no idea.
Yeah, I don't know, because it's always been a classic for me. Same, like in my lifetime. But I was only really aggressively watching films like in the early 90s. And by that point, it had already been solidified.
Maybe it's like once it hits... You know what? The advent of home VHS? Video. I bet you once it hit VHS, then people were started watching it. It's like how we do nowadays, where it's like, you know, no one sees it in theaters, and it comes to streaming, and people are like, oh my God, this is so good. It's like, yeah, why didn't you see it in theaters? But whatever.
But also now I can pause it and appreciate the artistry and look for the Easter eggs.
I can appreciate the artistry in a movie theater where I'm not on my phone.
Contemporary problems.
Yeah, that's true. First world problems, too.
I mean, really, it's a white man's burden.
Yes.
Very much. I am glad that it did not take the ending from the Shining novel. And I'm glad, like, a lot of people will talk about so much. A lot of people who are, like, huge King fans kind of agree with King, like, how it doesn't do much from the novel and it's worse or whatever. But, like, controversial statement, but not for you all. But, like, for many people, like, King's novels don't translate to film very well frequently.
And his endings have a tendency to shit the bed.
Well,
but okay. Like Tony being revealed to be an adult future incarnation of Danny coming back to him is like what the epilogue of The Shining is in the book.
Here's the thing. I think it works fine in King's novel. But again, because Stephen King is a softie at heart, like he has that sentimentality, that ending would not work in this movie because it has none of those qualities. It would feel so tonally out of place. I don't love it in King's novel, but it at least fits with the rest of the novel for me. It would not fit in this movie.
Yeah, I'll confess that's why I find a lot of the criticisms from people who really love the book a little unwarranted. Accepting the fact, like, the full caveat is that I'm not the biggest Stephen King fan. Like, I respect his work, I respect his output and what he has done for horror, but I'm not, like, a massive super fan. I kind of casually dip in and out every once in a while. But I think you also have to acknowledge a film is not a book. And, like, even the best adaptations are still liberal with what they choose to include and how they differ. And, you know, we can quibble with them. There's fascinating conversations to be had about, like, oh, well, why didn't they do this? And was this the right decision? But at the end of the day, this film is very different. And to say, oh, well, they should have done the ending of The Shining, the book. It's like, yeah, no, that doesn't fit because that's literally not what we're doing. We're making a movie of The Shining. Same basic ideas, but very different execution.
Yeah.
And then the last, like, deep dive thing I have, and I'm so grateful to have horror queers on for this, is just, like, queerness is all over this film, and it's beyond just the infamous bi furry scene, the BJ furry scene that happens in the film, but, like,
which I will say, though, I don't know why that scene is in this movie. The character of the man in the bear costume or whatever, it's in the book. But it's like, Kubrick, like, you did so much different. Why do you want this bit in the book, which literally makes no fucking sense? Even if you've read the book, it's kind of like, what?
Yeah.
I think it's just, it's one of those things, by virtue of setting it in a hotel, like, a hotel is a place where you can have anonymous sex. And I think it's also just a very evocative image. Like, I'm thinking of someone like Wendy, who has probably lived a pretty sheltered life. And I don't know, to me, she kind of reads as like, I was a virgin and then we got married and now we have Danny and I live my wifely duties. I think this is here because it's like, well, what would be incredibly shocking to Wendy? It's not just two men having sex. It's a furry giving a blowjob to this hotel manager.
So, but pace continues. So, like, so outside of that scene, though, you say queerness is all over this film. What do you mean by that?
And what I mean by that is, like, I mean, two things. First of all, in the way that horror, to me, is inherently a very queer genre in the ways that it deals with marginalization and what people do not want to look at and the way that queerness has been put in that same category. So there's that aspect of that, especially if you look at the film as when the ways in which the film uses queerness as a threat to white cis heteronormativity kind of thing. But then also, I think it was you, Joe, who mentioned, like, the liminality of the space of the hotel itself and the way that that setting just feels very queer in and of itself to me, and in the way that, like, all the characters get lost in this hotel in a way that feels very much, we are no longer in Kansas anymore, Dorothy kind of way. So or Toto kind of way. And so I feel like there's that nature of queerness too, and the queerness of setting, the queerness of unease, and the queerness of I wouldn't say this film is camp at all, but, like, there's almost this extravagance to the hotel in and of itself and in the mystery and maze of it that almost feels adjacent to camp for me.
I could see that.
Well, I think if we are thinking of queer as the more sort of traditional version of it, right, where it's like something is weird, something is right. off, the hotel definitely embodies that, like by virtue of having these ghosts and the way that spaces seem to change, you know, like even the experience in room 237 with this woman where she is one thing and then she's not. And, you know, I don't think a lot of people read it in the version of queer that we would traditionally
sure. But it is literally look at, right? queer in like the dictionary one definition of queer.
Right. Yeah. But I will say, Pace, because when you folks invited us to come on in this episode, and we were like, well, is there something queer, like gay, like lesbian, like bi, like trans in this movie that we could kind of use as an interesting conversation piece? And we couldn't really come up with anything off the top of our heads. But then I randomly discovered this hilarious, well, hilarious and interesting Reddit post that tries to make the argument that Jack Torrance is actually a gay man. And this is like his way of processing it. Like all of his relationships with the ghosts are all men. As I said earlier, they all kind of look like him, but they have much more intimate relationships than he appears to have with Wendy, right? Like there's yeah. no sense of affection between them. And you could say, oh, it's just because their marriage is struggling.
Yeah.
You know, Danny isn't well, like he hit their child and yeah. all that other stuff. But just like, you know, the way that the concierge cleans him off in the bathroom, and it's like, oh, there's a lot of like below the belt cleaning off yep, yep. of
this and even cream like the spill. Way he's stand Jack is standing there like in a very like hip askew, like in a way that could be read as queer, I would think. And then also when mm-hmm. he makes out with a woman in 237, like he's kissing this woman and then he oh, looks away. Oh, she's like, oh shit, she's gross. Well, I can't do this. Gross.
I will say this. So, you know, and we get a lot of complaints from people who don't actually listen to the show who are like, y'all are reaching or whatever the fuck. Mm-hmm. I don't buy into this reading really about Jack being a queer man. However, I wish that I would have seen that article before I watched it again, because I feel like, even though the movie doesn't really give you any kind of textual evidence to like mm-mm. support this claim, if you walk into this movie and be like, okay, Jack is a repressed gay man.
Right.
I think it would actually make it a very interesting viewing experience. And then you can look at all of Nicholson's choices, even though he probably was not thinking I'm a repressed gay man. But if mm-hmm. you apply that to every choice he makes, I think you could see that. So again, that's why I never turn down a reading, because again, at the very least, like if you want to take that read and walk into the film with it the next time, and you might come yeah. out with it like with a whole new appreciation, or you might fucking hate it. I don't know.
I will say, I was sort of trying to keep an open mind when I watched it. I hadn't actually discovered that thread, but I was like, okay, let's look for something in this movie. I read the bartender figure
yes,
as pretty Floyd. Queer.
Yeah.
And then there's also the second man who comes in during the interview, who is very like
right.
femme flamboyant.
And well, I'm you're kind even of that like, playboy. Oh my God.
Exactly.
He's like, a playgirl.
Hey girls, what are we talking about in this beigey salmon colored office?
We're talking about how his predecessor butchered his entire family and then blew his brains out. That's what we're talking about.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Even the way, like, with that little turtleneck he wears, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Look, I'm not saying I see penis. I'm just saying he's wearing a short turtleneck.
Well, I actually see penis in the carpet. It's like one of those magic eyes where it's like you just see what you want. You're like, no, like, inkblot.
Yes, you see what you want, Trace.
Yes. I see a lot of penises in that carpet. It's cocks.
Yes. Oh, my God. I love it. So, well, anything else that we didn't touch on that either of y'all picked up on in the film?
No, I mean, honestly, I feel kind of bad because I hadn't seen this film in a very long... Because I watched it, I feel like, a lot in that high school, like, early college age. And so I was like, mm-hmm. I just never... And it's, frankly, not a movie I care to revisit very often. I was happy to do it for this because I was like, oh, shit. Like,
it's
yeah,
a good excuse, right?
Yeah. But I was more focused on, like, again, absorbing new things since the last time I saw this. Was before I was even writing for Bloody Disgusting, before I was even writing like film criticism. So it was a new experience for me, but yeah, I didn't read much more into it analysis wise.
If our listeners really want some more deep analysis, that can be a little sketch, watch Room 237.
Have fun. There you go.
Well, yeah. Honestly, your reaction to it makes me want to watch it more.
Oh, it's worth a watch, even if you don't agree with everything that they're saying, because it kind of starts off at like what you would expect them to talk about. Like, right. Let's talk a little bit about some of the things that happened on the production and like what was Kubrick's intention and this kind of stuff. And then we start to talk about like faking the moon landing and other weird shit. And you're just like, what? Oh, we're going here.
I will say there are like a few reads in there that I genuinely really like. It being like an addressing the Holocaust, for instance. Like, I feel like it's a stretch, but like, I still genuinely like, or see what they're saying with that. The idea of it being like about Native American genocide, I really don't think that would be something Kubrick as a white dude from Britain would be super into. But
that one fucking line where you're just like, oh, it's a Stephen King story, so we're talking about it being built on a fucking Indian burial ground.
But given the setting for the film, that actually would make sense. Right. It just like, yeah, there's nothing here to really back that up for me.
Well, I guess we can rate the film. We're rating it out of 10 nightmares because this is our Nightmare on Elm Street series. Mm. But you can interpret that however you want. Nightmares it's can be fine. Good or bad, whatever. But for me, I think it's 9 out of 10. Still one of my favorites. And like you said, not many kills, but I still find the Jacksicle at the end is kind of a fun way for his character to go out, even if it's a little anticlimactic.
I need more GIFs of Jack Nicholson. I mean, I don't remember what scene it was, but there's just one scene where Shelley Duvall's talking to him. Maybe it's when she's giving him breakfast, but she's like, we should do this. And he looked at her like she's a fucking idiot. And
that face.
So it's an 8 out of 10, 8 nightmares out of 10. I do think this film is impeccably made. And like, whatever you want to say about Kubrick, like the attention to detail here is astounding.
Right.
I understand that the emotional distance and coldness is intentional. Unfortunately, that is an issue for me to where I just don't, I don't find this as captivating or as horrifying as a lot of people do. I respect this movie a great deal. And I think technically speaking, it is near perfect. I just don't have like the feeling there, you know, when you finish a film and you're like, fuck, I love that. I don't have that with this film.
So I'll confess I do, but it's because I am a bit of a Kubrick fanboy. Mm-hmm. Not the practice, but the artist. Thank you. Yes. Not the artist, the art. There we go. It's not my favorite of Kubrick's, but yeah, I do think it's a really astoundingly great film. I think there's new things to appreciate it. As I said, I really enjoyed rewatching it so I could appreciate Shelley Duvall's performance and know that we're going to get something new from her this year. That's exciting as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think for me, it's somewhere between about an 8.5 and a 9. Like Trace, there is something a little bit distancing from it, and it is by design. But at the same time, I'm like, okay, I'm happy to watch this movie, marvel at it, and then I'll take like a 3 to 5 year break and I'll come back and watch it again.
I mean, again, if anything, like I did finish this with holy fuck, the cinematography in this movie is astounding.
Oh yeah.
And that will bring me back for another watch.
Thank you again, both of you, so much for joining us on this episode. It, like I said, it's kind of a dream come true. Y'all have been my podcast heroes for a while in the queer podcast horror world. Where can our listeners find you all? Horror Queers, but also both of you. And do you have anything fun coming up?
So Horror Queers, you can find us at Horror Queers everywhere. Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. We've got a Facebook group. You can find us on Bloody Disgusting on their little podcast, Bloody FM channel. For me personally, you can find me at Traced Thurman. That's Trace D as in dog Thurman. Pretty much, again, everywhere. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, whatever.
And I can be found at B Stole My Remote, and that's the letter B, and that's primarily Twitter and Instagram. Yeah. And then I guess exciting for us, we are going to do a theme month in February that we're excited for because February is our birthday month. So we're doing a programming block of 4 weird sex films. So that's something to look forward to.
I was like, what theme are we doing in February? And sorry, it is our birthdays. Like both, it's not the podcast birthday. We have birthdays in February.
Important distinction.
My dog Gandalf shares a February birthday as well. February 20th.
Oh, nice.
20th.
Wait, 20 what?
February 20th.
I'm the 27th. Joe's the 9th, but I think think one of my dogs is the 21st, actually, in February. So there we go.
Oh, I find February is like a big birthday month. And I'm like, is that just like people were fucking back?
It's Memorial Day fuckings.
Okay.
Is it? I think. Okay.
Well, not for America. I don't know what it was for you in Canada, but.
I don't know what a Memorial Day is. Yeah.
Three-day weekend.
Love it. Well, our next episode will be our Nightmare on Elm Street retrospective, just kind of wrapping up our season and going through all of our Nightmare films. And that's it for our show. Our theme music was by Matt May. Horror Nerds at Church releases every Thursday. Please comment, rate, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Support us on Patreon and get access to exclusive movie commentary episodes, BooTube episodes, and more bonus content by going to patreon.com/horrornerdsatchurch. Only $5 to sign up, so significantly cheaper than a stay at the Overlook Hotel or or the Stanley Hotel. I mean, that's a expensive hotel. So expensive.
Stanley Hotel, by the way, it's definitely the thing where you're paying like several hundred dollars for a room, but the room is very small because you are, so a suite is like smaller than the size of your average hotel room.
Oh yeah. I believe it. I drove cross country. I used to live in Berkeley, and then I moved to DC for a while, and like we passed through, like we took a horror tour through all the states. Wow, we went through, and so one of the things we went to is Stanley Hotel, and I wanted so badly to stay there, but I was like, I cannot justify $300 for a little room. Not on this
I'll
trip.
Take a picture outside and yep. We'll continue driving.
Yeah.
But yeah, well, follow us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, Horror Nerds at Church, Twitter, HNAC Pod, for all the latest updates about upcoming films, news, and other announcements. And until next time, remember, all work and no play makes Jack a very dull boy, indeed, or maybe a repressed gay man.